drinking all night, shaking all day. It's the Drugstore Cowboy. That's it for the Wrecking Hours. Catch me next week for the theme week here on the WHFR. All the shows are doing theme week. It's auto show week, so we're doing auto theme. So get your engines ready for some revved up psychobilly. It's a hot rod psychobilly next week on the Wrecking Hours.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Yes, folks, hi, this is Wayne Hancock, and you're listening to WHFR, Dearborn, Michigan. Hope you dig it, man.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with David Montgomery, the author of a book called King of Fish, The Thousand-Year Run of Salmon. We'll also speak with Sarah Parsons from Change.org about a campaign to ban shark finning in California. And Avital Binstock from Sierra Magazine gives us some tips for greening your breakfast. We're here now with David Montgomery, the author of a book called King of Fish, The Thousand-Year Run of Salmon. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you on the show. Let's start by talking about what first got you interested in salmon as a topic for a book.
Well, you know, I'm a geologist, and so I get asked the question of why did a geologist write a book about salmon? And I'm the kind of geologist who works on rivers, and I teach at the University of Washington. And if you go out in the rivers in the Northwest, you run into salmon. And I started talking with fish biologists and started realizing that if you look at the land the way a geologist does, it actually explains an awful lot about the history of salmon.
And why is that?
Well, because salmon, they're really trapped in their stream. They can't sort of get up and fly to the next drainage basin to get out of the way of things that happen upstream. And the simple rule in geomorphology, my subdiscipline in geology, is that stuff goes downhill. The salmon's habitat is quite literally in the rivers and streams that drain off of landscapes. So whatever we or nature does in the uplands of a drainage basin sort of cascades down through their habitat. And if you look at the history of salmon in Europe and New England and the Northwest and potentially Alaska, the way that we've changed the way the land works has tremendous implications for how many fish can actually be supported in the landscape, even though we almost never take that into account in our decision-making.
What has the decline of the salmon population looked like?
Well, it's different in different regions. Around Seattle, the city that I live in, we've lost about 90% of our salmon historically from the Puget Sound area. If you look in California, they've lost like 95% or more. You look back in New England, more than 90%, probably 99% of the wild salmon are gone there. And Europe is pretty much the same, you know, not extinct, but very, very, very close to it in terms of wild fish. And so if you look at the condition of habitat in different regions, it kind of maps onto the abundance of fish. British Columbia still has about two-thirds of their historic salmon runs, and Alaska still has sort of a full complement of salmon.
And is that because there's just been less development in Alaska?
It's in great part, yes, but also differences in fisheries regulation and management. I mean, mm-hmm. a big part of why California lost their salmon was wildly rampant overfishing from the gold rush to the early 1900s. So salmon has, Alaska has fairly good fishing regulations, or has had them for a fair bit of the history of the fishery, but the habitat's in superb shape so far.
Let's take a step back and look at the fish. What makes salmon special? I mean, this has become an iconic species. You see a lot of attention paid to salmon, more so than many other kinds of fish. And why do you think that is? What's unique about them?
Well, other than the fact that they taste really good, I mean, they're a wonderful food resource. So, I mean, many human societies, you know, from ancient Scotland, where my ancestors came from, to the people that lived around Seattle before my ancestors got here, have used salmon as a dependable resource. But they're also an iconic species. A fish that travels, you know, 1,000 miles up a river to get to its spawning beds. It has a special quality to it that is hard to describe, but is easy to see. the fish that come back and fill rivers and streams, you know, wall to wall with salmon each year, it's pretty amazing manifestation of the natural abundance and beauty and wildness of nature. And that they did that throughout the Northwest really made them an iconic species in the Northwest. And one of the things I didn't realize when I started doing the research for the book was just how similar the numbers of native salmon historically were in Europe and in New England, and how much we've forgotten about them. So to me, the story of salmon is one in terms of how we can all too easily fail to appreciate, looking back in history, the natural abundance and beauty that's around us as we change things in ways that don't allow that to persist.
I think when people think about migration, they don't think of salmon as a migratory species. But tell us a little bit more about that 1,000-mile journey, about how salmon move from one place to another over the course of their life.
Well, you know, they're born in freshwater streams, in mountain streams generally. And they spend time incubating in the stream bed gravel and then growing into larger fish in their home streams. But then they go out to sea, and they put on like 95% of their body mass out in the ocean. Most of the nitrogen that's in a fish that swims back up the river was actually acquired out in the marine environment. So they essentially leave their home streams and go to the grocery store of the world's oceans, get much larger, and then come back to spawn and die. The Pacific salmon have one shot at spawning. Atlantic salmon can do it two or three times. I think the record may be four or so. 90% of them come back to their home stream. About 10% of them get lost or get a little adventurous and go to somewhere else or to a nearby stream. But they can undergo these incredible migrations out to the ocean, then around in the ocean, and then back to their home stream. So they're very well-traveled, but they're very faithful to the geography of their place. They come back home.
What do we know about how salmon find their native stream? I mean, once they've gone out to the ocean, you know, they're out in the huge, wide, open ocean, how do they find their way back to the one tiny stream in which they were born?
You know, that's a question that scientists have been really actively debating and engaged in for quite some time. And from what I can tell in the research I did from the book, and again, I'm a geologist, so this is a little out of my normal field, but it seems that the smell of the water, the chemicals are in the water, organic chemicals, a little bit of copper, what kinds of materials are in the drainage basin of their home, that they remember from their journey downstream, and they seek it out and find it in their journey back upstream. The best guess that I can see is that, you know, some people argue that it's they're reading Earth's magnetic field. Others argue that it's the smell of their home river. Odds are, in my opinion, it's probably a little bit of both. But the natural waters of different watersheds are fairly distinctive.
I've heard a little bit about the benefits that the salmon provide in terms of nutrients once they return to their home stream. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, if the rivers and streams of the Pacific Northwest, of Western North America in general, are fairly nutrient poor. There's not a lot of nutrients in them. But if you look at the nitrogen isotope composition of trees that grow along floodplains in the Pacific Northwest, something like a third of the nitrogen that's getting into the trees actually swam up the river as a fish and as a salmon. How can you tell? Because there's a heavy nitrogen isotope that gets put on in the marine environment that's not in the freshwater streams. And you can sort of trace that through the food chain. Something like 90% of the nitrogen in grizzly bears in the headwaters of the Columbia River originated as a salmon. So that you can think of salmon as essentially like a nutrient pump. By leaving the bait watershed, their home watershed, as a little fish and coming back as a really big salmon, they're basically importing nutrients to their home environment. And then when they die and decay, it feeds the bugs that then turn around, or the aquatic macroinvertebrates, as the ecologists would call them, that then turn around and feed the juvenile fish that then go back out to the sea. So they're part of a grand cycle for importing nitrogen and nutrients to freshwater streams. So they're a critical part of fertilizing aquatic ecosystems throughout much of their home range.
Let's shift gears a little bit here and talk about some of the current threats to salmon. And this isn't especially something you cover in your book, but the pebble mine issue is a very big deal right now. Is that something that you've worked on at all? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, I've thought about it a lot, and I've actually been up to Alaska and talked about it. The context of this book for thinking about the pebble mine is that the fishery in Alaska, the sockeye fishery, both in the Bristol Bay where the Pebble Mine is and then also at the Copper Rivers, are some of the last really healthy, really large salmon fisheries in the world. And the idea that one could develop a massive open pit mine in the headwaters of a salmon fishery in an environment like that, a glaciated, tectonically active environment, and not put at risk the salmon nurseries that are downstream in the same watershed, is truly a gravity-defying idea. It is an incredible to believe that we could actually do that, pull that off, and not impact the salmon fishery. And if you look at the history of salmon back in California, you know, from the California Gold Rush back to New England and back to England, it's a history of you know, humanity destroying one fishery after the other in pursuit of other things. Nobody tried to drive salmon to extinction in the areas where they're fairly close to it, but we prioritized other things in favor of preserving the fishery. The Pebble Mine is a really good example of that process playing out in a new region, in a new time, with new technologies, but it's kind of the same old story. And that's where the relevance of this book to that issue, I think, really comes in.
What do you think our listeners need to know about the most important ways to protect both salmon habitat and also ensure that the species grow and thrive?
Well, you know, I think the biggest message is that every river is a little different. I'm heading out to the Elwha River next week for the commencement of the removal of the dams on the Elwha River. There's some places where blocking the access of fish from going from their home stream to the oceans and back really is the critical issue. There's other places like the region around Seattle where it's probably the way we develop urban and suburban areas and how we change the way that water and sediment move off the landscape. We know enough about that now to develop and accommodate human interests without compromising the interests of salmon, but we don't do it that way. We're not requiring that. In terms of Alaska, you know, whether or not we could have giant open-pit gold mines in the headwaters of a salmon nursery is a question that I think is needs to be asked much more bluntly and directly at present. And so it's kind of the fish evolved with the landscape, and how we change the landscape is going to affect the future of the fish. It's that connection that I think we really all need to understand.
What other kinds of questions do people often ask you about salmon from this book that you think our listeners might be interested in hearing about?
They'll ask about the evolution of the salmon or the history of salmon in you know, what happened to the salmon in England or in New England, what happened to California's salmon. All those kinds of stories are in there. But the one that appeals to me as a geologist is that if you look at the evolution of salmon and you ask the question, why are there so many different species of Pacific salmon, the coho, the chinook, et cetera, and why is there just a single species of Atlantic salmon? Turns out that's rooted in the geologic history of eastern North America and the Atlantic margin versus western North America. And you can make the argument, as I have, that the Pacific salmon actually co-evolved with the topography, that the evolution of from broad coastal plains into the mountainous environments we know today drove the evolution of the different species of salmon. And when you start thinking about the way that the fish co-evolved with the topography, it sets the stage for thinking about what we're doing to terrain, to landscapes today, and how that's setting the future trajectory of salmon, for worse, or hopefully, if we can learn the lessons of the past, for better in turning it around.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
Boy, well, I would obviously encourage everyone to check out my book, Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations on the History of Agriculture, and my new book that'll be out in the spring called The Rocks Don't Lie on the History of Science and Religion.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to David Montgomery, the author of King of Fish, The Thousand-Year Run of Salmon. Joining us now is Sarah Parsons from Change.org to talk with us about a campaign to ban shark fins in California. Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, let's start by talking about what shark finning is. What is it and why is it a problem?
So finning is a process where fishermen catch sharks and slice off their fins and their tails and then throw the fish, which are oftentimes still living, back into the water where they sink to the bottom of the ocean to bleed or drown to death or get eaten by other marine creatures. So it's a problem because not only is it brutal, but it's really decimating shark populations. More than 73 million sharks are killed through finning every year, and it's pushed some shark species to decline by as much as 90% in recent years.
And what is the reason? I know that one of the main causes of this is that some people consider a soup made from shark fins to be a delicacy. Is that the only reason that the shark finning is taking place, or are there other things they use the fins for?
That's the main reason. Shark fin soup is a traditional Chinese dish. It's considered a sign of affluence to serve it at important events like weddings and banquets and major parties that a family might have. And the other reason that finning is so prominent is that shark fins fetch a very high price. Shark fin soup can sell for as much as $100 a bowl, so fishermen know that this is a very lucrative trade to get into.
Why is it such a problem, in particular, if we see these reductions in shark populations? There are a lot of other species that are endangered. Why is this one in particular drawing such concern from the scientific community and also just from people all over the globe?
So many species of sharks are actually being pushed to the brink of extinction, and that's a problem for sharks, but it's also a problem for ocean ecosystems as a whole, because sharks are considered apex predators, which means that they control or they keep the populations of many other marine creatures in check. So if you're seeing shark declines, you might see other species populations get thrown dangerously out of whack, and it really upsets entire ocean ecosystems. So this is not just a shark conservation issue. It's really an ocean conservation issue.
So really, for anyone who cares about the oceans, shark finning is a practice that should be of concern.
Absolutely.
So tell us about this campaign to ban shark finning in California. Is it to ban the finning of sharks? Is it to ban the sale of shark fins? And where is the campaign at?
So we currently have a campaign on change.org that was started by the Asian Pacific American Ocean Harmony Alliance. This is a coalition of Asian Americans that formed to give voice to Asian Americans who really want to support a shark fin ban. The campaign is in favor of AB 376, which is a bill in California that would ban the sale of shark fins in the state. And it was recently passed in the Senate. So right now, the bill is waiting on a signature from Governor Brown. He can either sign it into law or he can veto it. And we expect him to do that in the next couple of weeks.
Why California? Isn't shark fin soup served in a number of places, and would having a ban in just one state make a significant difference here?
Yes. So there are shark fin bans already in place in three states, Hawaii, Oregon, and Washington. California would be the fourth if Governor Brown does sign this legislation into law. The real issue with California is that the majority of U.S. shark fin consumption happens in California. It's actually about 85%. And San Diego and Los Angeles are two of the biggest cities for shark fin imports. So really, statewide legislation is especially important in California, where shark fin consumption is so high in this country.
You know, the opposition's main criticism to this legislation is that some people consider it to be an assault on the culture, on Chinese American culture, because shark fin soup, as you mentioned, is a traditional dish served at significant events. But I do think it's really interesting that this campaign was started and promoted by, as you mentioned, prominent members of California's Asian American community. So tell us a little bit more about that and the sort of reactions that they've gotten.
The Asian Pacific American Ocean Harmony Alliance is an organization that was founded even before AB 376 was put up for legislative proposal. And the organization is a group of Asian Americans that support a ban on the sale of shark fin. They started a petition on change.org a few weeks before the legislation was even proposed. They've been promoting it for the past several months and really working to gain momentum in the community, get other Asian Americans to speak out in favor of this bill. And I think what it really shows is that, you know, yes, shark fin soup is a traditional Chinese dish, but this group proves that it's not an assault on China. This bill is not an assault on Chinese culture. What they're really saying is, you know, culture can evolve. Extinction is forever. This is really an ocean conservation tool. It's not discriminating against a particular culture.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners or ways that they can get involved?
Absolutely. So, you know, it's not too late to support this legislation. So these next few weeks are really crucial for people to voice support for AB 376. So the Asian Pacific American Ocean Harmony Alliance really wants people to go to change.org and sign their petition and also call Governor Brown's office and say, you know, listen, I really support AB 376. It's a very important ocean conservation tool.
Thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Sarah Parsons from Change.org talking about a campaign to ban shark finning in California. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Binshtok, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Arlie.
And Avital's here today to talk with us about green living tips, as she often does on our show. Lately, Sierra Magazine's Green Life blog has talked about greening your breakfast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So let's talk about a few ideas for green breakfast.
Sure, of course.
We don't mean the actual color green. So what are some tips for how to make your most important meal of the day more eco-friendly?
Yeah, so we send out daily tips every week, and this seems to be a particularly popular topic, and people really got into it, I guess. People really do think this is the most important meal of the day, and mm-hmm. people get into their breakfast. So yeah, I wrote some tips about different aspects of your breakfast that you can go green on. And the first thing people think of when they think breakfast, or at least I do, is cereal. And yeah, your choice of cereal actually can make a difference in the environmental realm. And if you're worried that an organic or GMO-free or sustainably packaged brand will taste more like the package that it comes in than the cereal that you want to taste, I'm here to inform you that there are delicious cereals that we've actually tested in our offices. We've held a whole taste test, and some of these are just some of the best cereals I've ever tasted. And we had like 20 people tasting the different cereals in our office. And our number one winner is a brand called Early Bird Granola. And people loved a flavor called the Aloha recipe. And the owner of that company buys organic ingredients whenever possible. She recycles and composts all her waste. And she uses rice paper packages that actually biodegrade a lot faster than plastic. So that's an example of one just like ridiculously good brand in more realms than one.
And I know you also had your number two is Cascadian Farm, mm-hmm. which is a brand people can often find at their local health food store.
Exactly. This is a more commercially available brand. Our poor Sierra Club staffers that I subjected to this taste test, their favorite flavor of the Cascadian Farm brand was the Organic Kids Cinnamon Crunch.
Those poor staffers being forced to eat cinnamon sugar cereal.
Terrible. I know. Things I subject them to in the name of lifestyle journalism research.
So what's good about them from an environmental perspective?
So this company, Cascadian Farms, which is actually now a General Mills brand, I have to inform listeners, but it's this particular brand has been organic for more than 35 years. And by that, I mean Cascadian Farm, not General Mills. And they don't use any synthetic pesticides or herbicides or GMOs to grow any of their ingredients. So that's a real deep, long commitment to being green. Mm-hmm. And this particular cereal, the Cinnamon Crunch, a lot of our tasters compared it to Cinnamon Toast Crunch. So it's, you know, tastes the same as any other non-green brand, but it's, you know, green.
And I know we had a lot of other cereals, but I want to talk about some other breakfast things.
Sure.
And of course, with cereal, you want to be using organic milk or some kind of alternative like soy milk or almond milk.
Yeah, and you can even do organic soy milk as well.
Great. Now, obviously, better than any packaging and cereal, you know, Michael Pollan has a critique. Other kind of food people that we've talked with have had critiques that we tell people to eat organic and then sometimes we recommend packaged foods and really the best, healthiest, greenest option is to go with things that come right from nature. So when you think of that for breakfast, I often think of eggs.
Eggs, yep.
So what do we need to know about going green if we're eating eggs for breakfast?
Yeah, the two things that you want to consider with your eggs, doesn't matter if you like them scrambled, sunny side up. The first thing you want to think of is organic. Again, this is me as a broken record. And any food-related thing I talk about, that's what I'll mention first. Look for organic. And then with eggs, you also want to look at cage-free. So when you buy cage-free eggs, you're diverting your money away from factory farms, which are some of the most severely polluting things in our country. So if you're going with the cage-free eggs, you're more likely to be supporting small family farmers that care about their animals more, that care about their land more, that care about their region more. So those are a few huge reasons to buy cage-free eggs. And when you're buying organic eggs, you're supporting ways of feeding and raising animals that are free of pesticides and other chemicals, and antibiotics as well, and genetically modified, anything kind of freakish.
And then the other thing with eggs, of course, we've had people on our show talking about, this might sound crazy, but there are people in urban environments who are actually keeping their own backyard chickens in their backyard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that something that you recommend?
Absolutely. Yeah, there are it's really starting to not be seen as crazy at all. There's this proliferation of books about how to keep your own chickens. And they're not just for budding farmers out in the country. They're for people who live in suburbs. They're for people who live in cities. And, you know, keeping your own chickens is it's a really fulfilling, joyful way to get your food and make sure that, you know, the chickens are treated humanely and that there's not a bunch of toxic runoff from what you're eating for breakfast.
Last but not least, when you're cooking those eggs or cooking anything for your breakfast, what is green about your cookware?
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways to actually take your cookware green, take your kitchen green. And we actually ran a guide to eco cookware in Sierra Magazine in a recent issue. So you can go to sierramagazine.com to see that. And we did things like a spatula made from recycled water bottles, a trivet made of recycled magazines, and a company that's based in Wisconsin called 360 Cookware. They develop cooking systems that save energy and water, so like pots that are actually water-saving and energy-saving. So you can look for cookware that's actually developed to save resources. Another thing with cookware, it's always great to scour garage sales and thrift stores. You can actually find a lot of really good pans and utensils there. Go with the smallest pieces possible, too. The bigger pieces take longer to heat up, so you're using more energy. You're using more water if you're boiling something. So stick with the small stuff. And then for your bigger appliances, look for the Energy Star seal.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today and telling us how to green our breakfast.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Avital Binchtok, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics Radio. My 11-year-old son, like every 11-year-old boy in America, has the same three posters on his bedroom wall. Peyton Manning, Barack Obama, and Kai Rizdahl. I couldn't get to Manning or Obama, but I got to Rizdahl.
Support for the Freakonomics Radio podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio, offering the Stitcher mobile app. With Stitcher's free app for mobile phones, listeners can get the latest episodes of Freakonomics, NPR, This American Life, and thousands of other podcasts on demand without downloading or syncing. The free Stitcher Smart Radio mobile app can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/freak.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Rizdahl.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything, as it usually is. Dubner, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Kai, and I have a question for you,
if you
don't mind.
That's kind of the way these things go, isn't it?
On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate America's food, I'm curious to know?
America's food? Okay, big topics. 7.3.
Yeah, all right. So,
so is there a right answer or wrong answer?
No, there's no right answer. Right. I was curious to know, because you know why? We love to complain about our food.
Yes.
And for those who like to complain, there's a new book coming out called An Economist Gets Lunch by Tyler Cowen. And he explains how, he puts it, American food got bad. And some of the explanations are really interesting. For starters, he blames Prohibition.
A lot of good restaurants, they make a lot of the profits on the drinks. When you shut down their ability to sell wine, beer, and other drinks, basically it put them all out of business. Those quality restaurants, within a period of a year or two, they vanished.
But Prohibition was like 80 years ago, man.
It is true, but many profound effects have distant causes, as I've tried to teach you, Grasshopper. So, no, actually, it's not that. Anyway. But, you know, we did bounce back, but what we did is we bounced back in volume of restaurants. But a lot of them were diners and cafeterias. Cowen says that we began to cater more than any other nation to our children's palates.
Compared to a lot of Asian cultures or European cultures, when it comes to the food scene, very often in America, the child is in charge. And that, again, means soft and sweet and gooey.
Ew.
So you've got soft, sweet, and gooey taking center stage, plus, Cowen argues, a lack of new flavors. Now, can you guess why we didn't get any new flavors?
A lack of new flavors. No, I got nothing.
Immigration. That's the argument. Or really the lack of immigration.
Right,
so
right.
The Immigration Act of 1924 set quotas in this country that weren't lifted until the 60s. More immigration generally means more food innovation.
Right.
New, you know, everything. Spices, ingredients, know-how, strategies. And we weren't getting a lot of either of those.
Well, let me throw another one at you, though, just for the heck of it. What about convenience? We were in the 40s and 50s a more mobile society. We wanted convenience. We wanted frozen. We wanted drive-through, all that good stuff.
That's exactly right. And Cowen, he says that this is interesting. It's kind of a byproduct of World War II, which is that during the war, out of necessity, we had to learn to can and package and transport food on a much bigger scale than ever before. And then when the war ended, we liked our spam. We hung on to it. And
spam.
All
it's
those processes that came along with it. What's interesting, though, is that in Europe, World War II had exactly the opposite effect.
It shut down a lot of transportation. It shut down a lot of borders. So people ate very locally. They would grow things in their gardens. You know, they might even eat the family pet, do things that we might not find that tasty or that pleasant. But the result in Europe was to make things more local, not less.
All right, so now that I think about it, the family pet is probably like a cow or a pig, not Fido, right?
Depends on your family kind.
Depends on the, yes, okay.
I can't speak for your family.
That's,
I don't know.
That's right. And local makes sense too, right?
It does. And, you know, American food now, Cowen and just about everybody else argues, is on the upswing. And a big part of that is this local movement, the idea that we should all eat more local food, maybe all local food, which might taste better often. But as a solution to the food future, the idea of feeding more and more people around the world nutritious and affordable food, Cowen argues that the locavore movement is a little bit snobbish and a lot impractical.
The biggest food problem in the world today is that agricultural productivity is slowing down, and for a lot of the world, food prices are going up. And for that, we need more business, technology, and innovation, not locavorism.
Man. You are going to get such hate mail, can I tell you?
Well, I think we should direct the hate mail to you this time after the turkey breast incident, if you don't mind.
I'm still hearing about that. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. Couple of weeks, huh?
Talk to you soon, Kai. Thanks.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science news and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. Here's a scientist soundbite.
It turns out that people, in general, are doing a lot better in terms of health, education, welfare, and although the economic gap is widening dangerously, the overall averaged income and prosperity of the world is increasing.
That was futurist Jerome Glenn, co-author of the State of the Future report. By studying world trends in areas such as energy, food, and technology, a global think tank called the Millennium Project projects what the world might be like in the next 10 years through a yearly report called the State of the Future. Here to explain more is Jerome Glenn, the executive director of the Millennium Project. Mr. Glenn, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So tell us about the State of the Future report. What did it find this year in 2011, whether globally humanity is winning or losing the future?
Well, we track over 28 variables in one chapter on the State of the Future Index. It finds that most of the indicators of progress for civilization are improving. While there's some uncertainty about some, and obviously areas like environment, CO2, organized crime, general violence, corruption, and participation of people in voting are actually going the wrong direction. Whereas it turns out that people, in general, are doing a lot better in terms of health, education, welfare, although the economic gap is widening dangerously. The overall averaged income and prosperity of the world is increasing.
Maybe you could describe the process of what goes into this. From what I understand, it's a panel that looks into indicators that have actual research behind them. Tell us more about what goes into this report, please.
Yeah, this is the most extensive analysis of how to measure the future that has ever been done. And here's my evidence. When we began in 1996, we asked people what's going on in the world that could become a big deal in the future. And then we asked, because a lot of people looked at problems, then the next year we asked what could become a big deal that's good for humanity. In the third year, we put both of these together. And then we asked people, how would you measure progress or regress on these indicators? And there was something like 119 indicators. But we had to have real data behind them. When I say data behind it, we want to have 20 years of past data that we can project out 10. And then we ask these several hundred scholars, futurists around the world, to rate each of these variables in terms of how could they be worse in 10 years and how could they actually be plausibly better in 10 years. So that gives us a range between good and bad, so to speak. And then we add up all these indicators in this little mathematical process to create an integrated State of the Future Index, and that's how we do it.
And the State of the Future report is released every year. Would you tell us what's new in this report for 2011?
We've identified something around over 20 factors that are likely to increase food prices. And all of these factors, every single one, is going up. And this is extremely frightening because if current trends continue, business as usual, in 20 to 30 years, we're going to have an awful lot of social instability about food prices around the world. So we're going to have to change the way we eat, how we produce things, and what we eat if we are to make a more stable future. So those are a couple of slices. We also did one on the future of arts and industries about what new forms like augmented reality and new kinds of virtual systems in the arts and entertainment that are coming up in the future.
How is this report being used?
Well, think of it as a utility. Some people use our report to teach in universities. Some governments use it as input into their scenario process for the future of their countries. Businesses use it for their strategic planning process. It's a little bit like saying, what's the advantage of thinking ahead? But also to affect the policy and planning. The purpose of policy, of course, is to change the future. If it's going in a direction you don't like, then you've got to change policy.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about the 2011 State of the Future report?
We created the State of the Future to give a framework for thinking about the future as a system. We can't just look at one thing in the human body and to understand what's going on, just like in the world. The world is complex, but we can simplify the systems of the world, so to speak, to give a framework for thinking. So that, I think, is very important to understand, that just coming up with one thing or one issue or one challenge is not really helpful in the world.
Mr. Glenn, thank you for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
That was Jerome Glenn of the Millennium Project. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. You can find us as Earth Sky. One of the ultimate questions of science is, where did life on Earth come from? New evidence from the U.S. space agency NASA makes the strongest case yet that the chemical building blocks for life came from space. Meteorites have been found in the icy continent of Antarctica that scientists claim contain what are called nucleobases. These are compounds used by nature to make DNA. Here to explain more is chemist Michael Callahan of the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. He's the lead author of the report on the meteor findings published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So what are the main findings of the report you co-authored on meteorites and the building blocks of life?
Well, our research results have shown the building blocks, the nucleobases, which are the building blocks of your genetic material, DNA, are found in meteorites. People have known this for actually the last 50 years or so, but no one's been able to really prove definitively if these building blocks of DNA were extraterrestrial in origin or if they were the remnants of terrestrial contamination in the meteorite.
These building blocks, apparently they're not the building blocks of life that we see here on Earth. They're something different, and that's how you know that it's not just contamination.
That's correct. That's exactly right. When you look at biology, biology likes to use certain chemical compounds. And so if you count the number of nucleobases used in biology, it's really predominantly five structures, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. It only uses five structures for the nucleobase components. When you start doing chemistry where you're taking simple ingredients, simple precursors like these hydrogen cyanide molecules and water and ammonia, and you start reacting them, when you start analyzing these products from these reactions, you get the biological nucleobases, which you see in biology, right? But you also get other things. This chemical reaction doesn't really discriminate so much like biology does, and it makes a whole plethora of different types of molecules and variations of those nucleobases. So that's what we're seeing in the meteorite. We're seeing the variation of structures in the meteorite. So it's not necessarily some sort of alien or foreign DNA. It's what we observe because we're looking really at a chemical reaction. Now, if those components can be used later on, which is what the idea is why this would be so important, that you know these meteorites could have brought in some essential ingredients that may have assisted the origin of life on Earth, could those other unusual structures have participated in some sort of important chemistry? It's very well possible. It could have been important. But you don't see them now because over time, maybe evolution or things there in place change things enough that you don't see them anymore. But it's still important to kind of know what the starting material is.
Yeah, what's the impact of these meteorites to life on Earth? Maybe you could walk us through how meteorites can seed life, bringing in material from space. Walk us through how this works for listeners.
Sure. So there's theories out there that when the Earth formed, there was a period very early in the history of the Earth called the late heavy bombardment, where the planet was being constantly impacted by meteorites and comets and other foreign objects, you could say. And when you start studying these meteorites, you start finding a host of organic molecules that you do see in modern biology, such as amino acids. And now with our research, we can say nucleobases. And so these are essential components in all of life as we know it. And so you can kind of imagine, to get to life, it uses some pretty complex molecules. And so how do you build up those complex molecules? Where are the starting materials? Well, we think that meteorites could have been a significant contributing factor to bringing in some necessary material. And then that brings up the intriguing question, well, if this is occurring on Earth, could this be occurring elsewhere as well? So maybe these meteorites flying all over the universe, impacting different objects and bringing in some pretty important things. And if maybe the conditions are right, maybe the same sort of process for life could be happening elsewhere. So the likelihood of life elsewhere has kind of increased just a little bit more, I think, because these meteorites, you could say they're pretty ubiquitous, bringing in some important components as we view them as important, because of course we see them in biology.
That was NASA scientist Michael Callahan. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. And now we bring you a story on post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. On the line is Paula Schnierb, Deputy Executive Director of the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder at the U.S. Veterans Administration. She's here to tell us about the latest science on PTSD as it affects military servicemen and women. Dr. Schnierb, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What do scientists know at this point in 2010 about PTSD and about who gets PTSD and who doesn't?
Well, the first thing we know is that most people exposed to a traumatic event such as combat don't develop PTSD, but that certain factors make a person more or less likely to develop it. Probably the most important factor is the nature of the combat or the traumatic event. So the more severe it is, whether someone's injured, how long it lasts, how many times it occurs, increases the risk. Furthermore, what happens after a person's been traumatized also makes a difference. A supportive recovery environment, the absence of stress and further traumas can all be protective. Conversely, returning to further stressors, having additional traumas, marital difficulties, job problems, and the like can make things more difficult. And lastly, even though in chronological order it's the reverse, who a person is going into a traumatic event matters too. The experiences a person has had leading up to deployment to a war zone or any kind of event can make the person more or less likely to develop a PTSD. One factor is the person's age. Up to early adulthood, the younger a person is, the more likely they are to develop PTSD. The more education they have, the less likely. If they've had childhood stressors and trauma, they're more likely.
Well, Dr. Schnierb, thank you for speaking with us today. I appreciate it. What's the most important thing that you want people today to know about soldiers and PTSD?
Perhaps there's two. And the first thing is that not all soldiers have PTSD. Even soldiers and other military personnel who have problems readjusting to society, well, that's normal. And coming from a war zone back to a large town or a small town in the U.S. or elsewhere, it can take some time. So your listeners should remember that not everyone returning from Iraq or Afghanistan has PTSD. The second thing is that we have effective treatments. So any of your listeners who are struggling with PTSD, or if they know someone struggling with PTSD, the important thing to know is that those people can be helped.
That was PTSD expert Dr. Paula Schnurr. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. You might think of scientists as just dealing with the abstract world, but the making of things, useful things, can lead to new scientific discoveries. One scientist who's done just that is inventor and materials scientist Joseph D. Simone, a professor of chemistry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and professor of chemical engineering at North Carolina State University. Dr. DeSimone, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, your research spans a broad range of science, medicine, technology, chemistry, material science. How would you describe what you do?
We lie at the interface of a lot of different things, and I think at one level we're problem solvers, another level we're entrepreneurs, and at the end of the day we're material scientists. We like to apply the capabilities of polymer science and new polymer chemistries to tackle problems that range mostly today in life sciences, but as well in some areas of colloids and material sciences.
Will you speak to the process of making things, something that you're very good at from what I understand? Two examples, the bioabsorbable stents, and also something that you're working on nowadays as well, these incredibly small and precise templates to deliver new medicines inside the body. Talk a little bit about this process of how making things can lead to innovation. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so the stent one was a terrific example and a terrific opportunity and experience. I met a man named Richard Stack, who was an interventional cardiologist at Duke University. He had shared with me this idea of having a bioabsorbable stent. He needed the polymer support and technology to help pull this off, and the challenge is daunting. I mean, most stents are metal, but you look back and you realize that before there were stents, it was just angioplasty, just opening up a blood vessel, and most people did okay with that, but sometimes those blood vessels would collapse and they needed to be propped open, and so a stent made a lot of sense. But why have a permanent prosthetic to a temporary healing issue? And that was the premise, and that was Richard's idea. And so we worked closely with him and developed a polymer-based stent that had the requisite mechanical properties to be balloon deployed and act like a metal stent, and then would provide mechanical support but eventually would dissolve or degrade just like a bioabsorbable suture would. And then after a couple years, it's gone. So it's pretty exciting to see it go from basic concepts in less than a decade into many, many people. And now what we're doing is bridging two other areas. So actually back in my PhD work, at Virginia Tech, I got exposed to a technology called lithography. And lithography is a basis by which polymers are used to make patterns on silicon wafers to make circuits, transistors. And it's the backbone of the semiconductor industry. And what we're doing now is that we're harnessing the manufacturing techniques of the computer industry and applying those techniques to make a new vaccines and medicine. And so we're basically making particles, delivery vehicles, that are extremely uniform. They have all the precision and uniformity of transistors, and applying that to making particles. And so now we have a platform we call PRINT, Particle Replication and Non-Wetting Templates. It's a particle molding technology, and to make particles of controlled size and shape. And then we bring our chemical acumen and capabilities to design new chemistry such that we can make particles that are highly functional to do things that we want them to do. Deliver nucleic acids, deliver chemotherapy agents, seek out certain types of cells versus other cells. And so we're using these details of size, shape, chemistry, and elasticity to enhance the performance of vaccines and medicines.
That was inventor and materials scientist Joseph D. Simone. That's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, 100 Flowers, Maneja Beto, and the Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't have you terrified. What you don't know won't hurt ya. But you don't know, but you don't know, but you don't.
What's in the box? Whatever it is, it must be pretty important, because I've traveled with it, moved it from apartment to apartment to apartment. Sound familiar? Did you know that we Americans have about 3 times the amount of space we did 50 years ago? 3 times. So you'd think with all this extra space, we'd have plenty of room for all our stuff, right? Nope. There's a new industry in town, a $22 billion, 2.2 billion square foot industry, that of personal storage. So we've got triple the space, but we've become such good shoppers that we need even more space. So where does this lead? Lots of credit card debt, huge environmental footprints, and perhaps not coincidentally, our happiness levels flatline over the same 50 years. Well, I'm here to suggest there's a better way, that less might actually equal more. I bet most of us have experienced at some point the joys of less. College, in your dorm, traveling in a hotel room, camping where you got basically nothing, maybe a boat. Whatever it was for you, I bet that among other things, this gave you a little more freedom, a little more time. So I want to suggest that less stuff and less space are going to equal a smaller footprint. It's actually a great way to save you some money, and it's going to give you a little more ease in your life. So I started a project called Life Edited at lifeedited.org to further this conversation and to find some great solutions in this area. First up, crowdsourcing my 420-square-foot apartment in Manhattan with partners Mutopo and Jivoto.com. I wanted it all. Home office, sit-down dinner for 10, room for guests, and all my kitesurfing gear. With over 300 entries from around the world, I got it, my own little jewel box. By buying a space that was 420 square feet instead of 600, immediately I'm saving 200 grand. Smaller space is going to make for smaller utilities, save some more money there, but also a smaller footprint. And because it's really designed around an edited set of possessions, my favorite stuff, and really designed for me, I'm really excited to be there. So how can you live little? Three main approaches. First of all, you need to edit ruthlessly. We've got to clear the arteries of our lives. That shirt that I haven't worn in years, it's time for me to let it go. We've got to cut the extraneous out of our lives, and we've got to learn to stem the inflow. We need to think before we buy. Ask ourselves, is that really going to make me happier? Truly? By all means, we should buy and own some great stuff. But we want stuff that we're going to love for years, not just stuff. Secondly, our new mantra, small is sexy. We want space efficiency. We want things that are designed for how they're used the vast majority of the time, not that rare event. Why have a six-burner stove when you rarely use three? So we want things that nest, we want things that stack, and we want to digitize. You can take paperwork, books, movies, and you can make it disappear. It's magic. Finally, we want multifunctional spaces and housewares. A sink's combined with a toilet. A dining table becomes a bed, same space. A little side table stretches out to seat 10. In the winning life edited scheme, in a render here, we combine a moving wall with transformer furniture to get a lot out of the space. Look at the coffee table. It grows in height and width to seat 10. My office folds away, easily hidden. My bed just pops out of the wall, two fingers. Guests move the moving wall, have some fold-down guest beds. And of course, my own movie theater. So I'm not saying that we all need to live in 420 square feet, but consider the benefits of an edited life. Go from 3,000 to 2,000, from 1,500 to 1,000. Most of us, maybe all of us, are here pretty happily for a bunch of days with a couple bags, maybe small space, hotel room. So when you go home and you walk through your front door, take a second and ask yourselves, could I do with a little life editing? Would that give me a little more freedom? Maybe a little more time? What's in the box? It doesn't really matter. I know I don't need it. What's in yours? Maybe, just maybe, less might equal more. So let's make room for the good stuff. Thank you.
The WHFR Monday Forum. An hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday.